Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. Sending in for Andrea Tuck this week, I'm Carlotta Ribello. Coming up on the program.
Most of the steeper portions were built out long ago and are not likely to change very much given the sort of politics of urban change in San Francisco.
How do you build a city on such steep topography? Join us as we head to San Francisco to find out. Then we hear about Vienna's plans to reduce property speculation and get an architectural tour of Yugoslav cities. All that and more coming up right here on The Urbanist with me, Carlotta Ribello. So welcome to this week's program. Ben Grant is Urban Design Policy Director for the Urban Policy and Planning think tank SPUR in San Francisco. He tells us about the history of San Francisco's urban design, the politics that divided it, and why San Francisco has brilliant views but needs to work on its close-up. Plus, how a plan to build the city on top of the roads rather than on street level failed. Here he is.
So obviously the topography of San Francisco is very dramatic, very steep, and one of the things that visitors love to do is walk or drive up and down some of our very steepest streets just because of the extremity of that experience. I think in a contemporary situation, that's actually not that big of a deal. People have various motorized ways of getting around, and we have figured out the engineering to where we don't have to worry too much about that. In truth, most of the steeper portions of San Francisco were built out long ago and are not likely to change very much given the sort of politics of urban change in San Francisco. Many of the cities are sort of preserved or as we like to say, pickled in place for better or for worse, you know, at preserving that wonderful character, but also having an impact on our ability to change and grow as a city. But historically, that was anything but the case. In fact, the challenge of building a city on such extreme topography informed a lot of the city making of the 19th century when San Francisco was first being built and first growing. Among other things, there were various attempts to level the city, to slice off the tops of hills. There was very briefly a policy in place, I believe in the 1870s, where no street was allowed to be steeper than a certain sort of modest grade, and hence for a few years there were dramatic attempts to flatten the hills, leaving buildings stranded well above the street grade in the few places where they actually started to do this, and then cooler heads prevailed about the feasibility of actually flattening the entire city and what that would actually take. I don't think the debate was so much aesthetic at that moment as just practical, the engineering of doing that to an existing city. Although similar things have been done in other cities, both Seattle and Chicago had major sections of their cities change level through large engineering projects, primarily to deal with drainage issues and public health dimensions, things like that. But in San Francisco, that attempt was very short-lived. But there are other stories about there's a famous episode of the Second Street Cut where in an attempt to facilitate a flatter street connection between downtown and the docks of the southern waterfront, a dramatic cut was made to the adjacent hills and essentially ruined the fortunes of one of the snazziest neighborhoods at the time in Rincon Hill, which was where the elites lived. But once the Second Street cut was made, you had traffic going through and you had houses falling into the cut and hillsides eroding. And so wrangling with the topography has been a challenge over the years. And while it doesn't really present engineering challenges so much anymore, it is a part of our history. And it also reveals itself in the sort of marvelous character of the city as it goes over the hills. One other episode in the relationship between building San Francisco and the topography was the invention of the cable car. In 1873, Andrew Hallady, who was a mining engineer, brought some of the technology from the mines of the Sierra Nevada for taking mine carts through these deep tunnels, brought it to San Francisco and deployed it as public transit in the form of the cable car. And that enabled for the first time large numbers of people to easily climb the hills. And very quickly you had a run on hilltop real estate, which is always drier, has beautiful views, clean air, and so forth, compared to the sort of mucky industrial city of that time. So very quickly, as soon as the cable cars made it possible, you had the sort of mansions of the robber baron families were quickly established on the tops of those hills, made possible by the cable cars. So tackling that topography and the technological innovation that made that possible with public transit really drove the property values and the nature of the growth at the top of the hills. And now you see that most notably on top of Nob Hill, where you have the mansions of the early industrialists, many now turned into hotels, that were made possible by that technology.
As an urban planner, when you're trying to change the, you know, you talked about the long view and the short view, how do you kind of take the aesthetic of the long view and trying to apply it to the short view? What sort of things are you having to think about to try and do that?
Well, I think as a city, we really excel in our relationship to our large-scale landscape and open spaces. But when it comes to our streets and sidewalks and plazas, it's less a part of the culture. It faces challenges of climate and temperature. It's where we come face-to-face with our homeless problem, which is really the shame of the city, and very much in tension with our sense of ourselves as a bastion of progressivism and liberalism and compassion. And it is not a city that has as strong of a culture of public life as many cities of equal fame or stature. You know, every city has places where it excels and places where it struggles. And I think the public realm has not been our strongest suit. On the other hand, I think we've made great strides in this city in the past 20 years. There has been a greater understanding of what makes cities work. I think our architecture of our newer developments in the past 10 to 20 years has had a more affirmative relationship between the building and the street after a long period of really severe mistakes, where buildings really turned their back on the street, really turned their back on public spaces, and we really allowed the accommodation of the automobile to drive the form of our city. So leaving aside debates of aesthetics, of which there are plenty here, and the sort of modernists versus the traditionalists and so forth, the building of any style has to navigate the relationship between the building and the public realm. And that is a place where, for a long time, we really got it wrong. And I think we have made some considerable strides there where we're doing better, and we have a planning department that's very sophisticated about urban design. In addition, we have added some wonderful new spaces that are really exciting and starting to sort of change that narrative of the public realm. I think in particular the new Transbay Park, which just opened on the rooftop of the Transbay Transit Center, which is currently a major bus terminal into the city, but will also in the future accommodate both commuter rail and California high-speed rail. If we're so fortunate as to get that over the finish line, that will be our major urban terminal. And the roof of that building has a spectacular new park that so far, I mean, it's only been open for a matter of weeks, but so far it is really being embraced by the people of San Francisco. The challenge of it being up off the ground, which is always tricky to make a space work that is not at street level, seems to be being overcome by successful management and a lot of enthusiasm and desire on the part of San Franciscans to take advantage of it.
That was Ben Grant from SPUR in San Francisco. With land prices in Vienna relentlessly on the up, the city's socialist administration is keen to reduce property speculation, especially since it's about to begin building more social housing. Last year, it updated the city's building code, putting a price cap on new residential areas, meaning that land prices in those areas are now just one-fifth of their market worth. Monocle's Alexei Korolyov in Vienna reports.
Vienna, one of the best cities in the world to live in. It's got everything you need for a good life. A solid education system, hearty food, high culture, and a whole bunch of Austrians. But above all, it's got some of the most affordable housing in Europe, the product of decades of socialist rule. But there's a problem.
In a lot of European and I also think American cities, the prices for housing goes up and up and up and up, and there's one main driver in Vienna, and I think in a lot of other cities also, it's the price for the property.
And so Vienna City Hall came up with a solution. 2/3 of all newly designated residential land must be zoned for social housing.
My name is Christoph Chorherr. I'm a member of the Green Party. We are here in coalition, Social Democrats and Green. And now we produced a new building law. And then we limit the price for rent to €5 per square meter, which is quite affordable. And also the price for the property is limited. So we hope that we can produce a lot of additional subsidized affordable houses through this legislation.
I've been myself advocating ideas of limiting land prices, of actually reducing land, private land ownership. So,
Austrian architect and urbanist Gabor Heindl says the legislation is a step in the right direction.
I think that this new zoning law actually gives a very good sign to the international world that land grabbing isn't really much wanted in Vienna, at least for those zones which are now still agricultural or not yet building land and which also are subject to large-scale speculation.
While the legislation is good news for Vienna's current and future residents, the landowners are not so thrilled. Some of them have even accused City Hall of expropriation. But Gustav Chorherr says this is a necessary measure. It may hurt now, but it will bring great rewards in the future.
Whom do we want to come to Vienna? So if we want interesting young people, if we want students to come to Vienna, affordable houses is the alpha and omega. So I'm quite afraid, for instance, for San Francisco, that the future technical development would be quite difficult because for normal people it's not possible to live there anymore because of the housing prices. So we want more and more students, young people, to come to Vienna. And if they want to live in the city, they should have the opportunity. The alternative would be to be quite critical with other cities like in London or in Munich or in Paris. You must move far, far out and drive in 1 hour or more every day because in the city you can't get affordable houses. So we try to keep a city in a mixed use, to keep also rich and poor, old and young, educated, non-educated, to give them opportunity to stay here. So I'm quite happy that we got that through. Now it's law, and I think lots of thousands of additional affordable houses will be built within the next years.
Even though the zoning changes are in force already, it will take some time for them to be felt. But this shouldn't stop you from dreaming. A last word from architect and urbanist Gabor Heindl.
If we talk about a vision, really, or a utopia for the city, and that is not only the city of Vienna, but every comparable city in other places, then I do think that the land issue will become a really enormous one. And in fact, I believe that ultimately there should be no private ownership of this limited resource of land where it's actually so much needed in urban areas. I think there's a difference between urban places, cities and the countryside. But urban land is much more a common thing, yeah, and a common interest than it should be a private commodity to put your money instead of into the banks. And that is actually what makes the housing prices go so high in Vienna, or you could even say skyrocket as well as in other places.
For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Now, if you want to find out all about the wonders of Yugoslav urbanism, then this weekend's your last chance at New York's Museum of Modern Art. The exhibition, Towards a Concrete Utopia, is ending its six-month run. It's been shining a light on how the Tito era shaped life in Yugoslavia's cities. But why settle for a museum when you can still see the projects in person? In Serbia's capital, you can take a tour around New Belgrade's concrete block Bonanza. And you'll be pleased to hear that your guide will chauffeur you around in a Zastava 101, better known to most of the world as the Yugo car. Our Balkans correspondent Guy Deloni went along for the ride.
Hi, my name is Nina Ivanovic and I am the operations manager for Yugo Tours.
Yeah. This is because I'm driving slow, don't worry about that.
What's the philosophy of Yugo Tours?
To give people a chance to explore the remains of Yugoslavia in a vintage car and to have an authentic experience, to feel, hear and smell Yugoslavia.
How would you describe those feelings, those sounds, those, as you say, smells?
The smell of gasoline leaking. When I sit inside this car, I really feel like I'm in a time machine. There is something so authentic about it, about going back so many years behind. All the cars that we have are from the 70s and 80s, so really the old models. And on the tour, we take people to places that are important for the communist Yugoslavia.
My name is Danica Jovović-Prodanović and I'm architect myself. And I'm also co-founder of the Belgrade International Week of Architecture. Before this exhibition in MoMA that happened this autumn, there was a very big research project that was organized within ex-Yugoslav republics that was called Unfinished Modernization. And authors from that project were actually the leaders and the main curators of the exhibition that happened in MoMA afterward.
Why do you think this is happening now, though?
This is a very small country, for instance, Yugoslavia, with very big diversity of architecture. That's why I think it's important. Of course, it's very important for us, and I think it's very important for us to recognize the value of that heritage, because it's always like that. When you show something abroad, it's more important than showing it here. Also, the problem is that kind of heritage wasn't valued enough for all of us here. And this is also the need to preserve it and to take care about it, etc., etc. So,
what were the big ideas, though, when people are looking at it now? What will people be taking away, do you think, that they can think, now there's something, regardless of the ideology behind it, regardless of the times in which we were living, that was valuable, that we should recognise, and which we could do with using today?
Definitely it's the quality of the space. I mean, the quality of the urban design, the quality of the social housing. If we are comparing nowadays social housing, it's much better way how they planned the housing. So it was really the quality of space that was produced at that time.
The car is a bit cold now, so maybe it's too loud, but it will get warm.
We're actually sitting outside an exhibition in Belgrade, which is a reflection of the upsurge in international interest in Yugoslav times, in Yugoslav ideas, Yugoslav architecture and Yugoslav urbanism. Is this something which is you're seeing reflected in your business, that people are really sparking now with these ideas? It's not about the nostalgia, it's about the hunger to find out what were the ideas in the Tito era and how we can use those ideas today, perhaps.
We have a lot of interest in the architecture tour that we are offering. We have seen a rising interest in the architecture of Yugoslavia. And for me, it's not only about seeing these buildings, but it's really vital to know the story behind the buildings and to understand what was the idea behind it. Some are disappointed when they see big, ugly buildings.
but other people, they are struck by the urbanism ideas which are in there. Relatively self-contained city blocks with greenery, healthcare, schools, shopping, accommodation, all of which is good enough for people to live in the centre of the capital city.
Yes, I think that New Belgrade is a monument itself. When I was younger, I didn't see it like that, but now I think it's really a monument of the Yugoslav times, and there are so many interesting things that we need to discover and explore when it comes to communist architecture, the architecture of Yugoslavia.
Monocle's newest bureau has just opened its doors in Los Angeles. It's a city that people often say only exists in the movies. But for a young film lover growing up in a world away in dusty Australia, it didn't sound like a true story. The magic of the movies had to start somewhere. So Monocle's Ben Ryland embarked on his own expedition through the winding streets of the Hollywood Hills, where some of the city's most fascinating homes still stand and where some of its most exciting stories were born.
I was seated at a street-side table on Sunset Boulevard, seeking refuge from the fierce Californian sun by way of an oversized iced tea, when I caught a nearby tourist wonder aloud where the famous mansion seen in Billy Wilder's 1950 classic film Sunset Boulevard might be located. It reminded me of William Holden's character dismissing Norma Desmond's sprawling residence.
It was a great big white elephant of a place. The kind crazy movie people built in the crazy 20s. A neglected house gets an unhappy look. This one had it in spades.
My first visit to Los Angeles came long after that house had been replaced by an office tower. I just caught a screening of the classic film noir Too Late for Tears, and scenes of its star Elizabeth Scott driving frantically all over dimly lit 1940s Hollywood were still fresh in my mind.
Well, I'm just taking my cue like a little gentleman.
You're taking it a little too fast.
Isn't that what you wanted?
Did you notice where the liquor was when you went through my kitchen?
Sure.
Go make us a drink.
Elizabeth Scott stopped making films in the mid-1950s and, even during her career peak, rarely gave interviews. I wondered about the view she must have had of the city's evolution from her longtime home in the hills. I knew an interview was out of the question, but she often responded to queries by post that sparked her interest. We had been exchanging a few letters, and she'd agreed to a meeting at her home. The area of Los Angeles known as Hollywood is really a small player in the city's wider urban landscape, but it symbolizes far more than a location. The movies gave the city its mythology, and it's the people tucked away behind the closed doors of the mysterious Hollywood Hills homes who give the town its legends. It's within these walls that the city's character was crafted, studios started, classics created, dreams destroyed. It's also a town of contrasts, both the birthplace of American glamour and its first greasy tabloid magazine. Leaving behind the grid of downtown Hollywood, I tucked my map away and headed for the hills. Many of the houses along Valley Oak Drive hark back to an age not so long ago yet, almost completely forgotten.
You can turn your dreams to gold. Oh, we're in the money. We're in the money.
The early 30s was a strange time for the movie business. The first picture with spoken dialogue had beckoned the end of an era as movie studios grappled with how to handle lucrative stars who had tantalized crowds in their masses on the silent screen, yet couldn't deliver a spoken line to save themselves. Ramon Navarro was one of the relatively few exceptions. After starring in 1925's silent epic Ben-Hur, the film that helped establish MGM as the greatest movie studio of them all, the dashing young actor was one of the world's greatest stars.
Love has nothing to do with marriage.
No?
No. Love is women. The excitement of the chase. The thrill of conquest.
In the spring of 1930, Navarro had just taken home a healthy $125,000. But when his payment for a new car was declined, he made a devastating discovery. One of the screen's biggest stars of the day was left with an account balance of just $160. Just as the great walls of the studio backlots ensured secrecy for the movie magic conjuring within, old Hollywood secluded its stars from scandal wherever possible. Navarro kept the betrayal quiet, but covered his losses by taking possession of Samuel's newly built home designed by Lloyd Wright, the son of Frank Lloyd Wright. The palatial Samuel Navarro House watches over the Hollywood Hills and stands as one of the city's longest surviving masterpieces of Art Deco design. With a Mayan-influenced exterior, the lush interiors were assembled by MGM art director Cedric Gibbons, who filled the home with curiosities, courtesy of luxury department store Bullock's Wiltshire. Another Art Deco marvel still standing on Wiltshire Boulevard. Much of Los Angeles was built for one purpose, to be seen. It's a voyeuristic kingdom built upon an industry of watching, a sentiment reflected in its palaces, from the cave-like Sheets Goldstein House on Angelo View Drive and its floor-to-ceiling glass walls, to Frank Lloyd Wright's Stora House on Hollywood Boulevard and its bizarre temple-like textile blocks. Then there are the less obvious homes, small, quaint, swimming against the tide of what Hollywood tells us it's all about. The one-bedroom mid-century studio city house where Rock Hudson was photographed for Architectural Digest might not match the splashy celebrity we imagine. Similarly, Elizabeth Scott's secluded home towards the winding peak of Hollywood Boulevard is a world away from Norman Desmond's foreboding castle walls in Sunset Boulevard. Perched like a farmhouse atop all of LA, one might imagine that stepping through the gates of a noir legend's home might be like travelling through time. Instead, the house designed by Robert Byrd in 1940 stands as a landmark of elegant and timeless design, with panoramic views taking in the downtown district, the Paramount Pictures backlot, where the scene of Norma Desmond's unexpected visit to Cecil B. DeMille took place, and the neighbouring Hollywood Forever Cemetery. Bouncing down the path with entirely unexpected energy, her hair was still as blonde as it shone during her final starring role opposite Elvis Presley, and her style was still as casually confident as her few public appearances alongside co-stars Humphrey Bogart and Kirk Douglas in the 1940s. Nearly 60 years after her final leading role, she remained quite literally on top of all of Hollywood. Cities change, and so too do their buildings. Yet, as the friendly character of her home suggests, she was far from a Norma Desmond-style recluse. Elizabeth Scott and Ramon Navarro came from a generation of movie makers who understood the value of mystery, and their homes reflect that timeless sensibility. Like their owners, many of them crazy movie people, the houses of the Hollywood Hills have watched countless grand dames of the cinema screen rise and fall. And here they stand, just as tall as ever.
That was Monocle's very own Ben Rylan. And that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. I'm Carlotta Ribello, and the show was edited by David Stevens. Andrew Tuck will be back on this chair at the same time next week. For now, to play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Courtney Barnett with City Looks Pretty. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.